Hello and welcome to the LGC News Roundup, the podcast from the Local Government Chronicles news team, where we look at the biggest and most significant stories of the week for councils. I'm Sarah Calkin, the LGC editor, and today I'm joined by reporter Megan Kenyon in the studio. And later we're going to be catching up with Deputy News Editor Jessica Hill as well, who is remote today as she has a poorly child. So we're here, Megan, 3 hours, I think, just over after Liz Truss resigned, which is good for our purposes. We wouldn't want to be recording while there was still that uncertainty going on. And you were at the LGA, the Local Government Association, when it happened. It's covering some meetings taking place there. So what was the sort of initial immediate reaction?
Yeah, so basically, I showed up for Councillors Forum at about midday, and that meeting had kind of gone off without a hitch. And then in the middle between Councillors Forum and the Executive Advisory Board, I was having my lunch and Liz Truss resigned. And I came back in and bumped into a couple of people who were attending the Executive Advisory Board, and I think one person said to me, "It's like absolutely remarkable what's happened." And I think I'd already had a couple of conversations with some Conservative councillors who were there, and they had basically said that this kind of turmoil is, you know, it's not great for getting things delivered on the ground. I think there was a sense that, you know, the parliamentary party is kind of having this psychodrama and really sort of trying to work out what it is basically, but that is having real world consequences for actual councillors on the ground and councils trying to deliver things like investment zones and you know, like just daily services that councils have to deliver.
Absolutely. I mean, the investment zones, so we reported earlier this week that there've been hundreds of sites have been put forward to become an investment zone. So they were first announced in the mini budget, and then councils were given 2 weeks to get their expressions of interest in, you know. So that's a kind of, again, central government just kind of expecting councils to be able to drop everything and pull together these bids. Now, I think most of these sites are, or probably almost all of them, are sites that, you know, councils already had plans for, and they're just looking to, maybe this investment zone idea could provide the sort of cash and investment and sort of boost we need to actually get this off the ground. But still, that, you know, it was county councils and combined authorities that were getting to put forward the sites, so that necessarily entailed local negotiations within those combined authorities and within those county councils about how many sites they should put forward. And we did some research, well, our colleague Kirsty did some research, and I think she identified 82 sites put forward by just 14 councils. And I think Norfolk had put forward the most at 23. So a lot of sites anyway, which just, I mean, it goes to show like how much potential there is and how many ideas councils have got for generating local growth in their areas. But yet, yeah, we're going to have another new Prime Minister, the third Prime Minister this year. We're already on to our fourth Chancellor, and, you know, nothing, policies announced, and then it just doesn't get delivered. And then, and another kind of related area in the sense it's a policy that councils have been spending time working up for, and then we heard that it's probably going to be delayed for a year, was the care cap. And I think you wrote about that earlier this week.
Yeah, I did. The Times had reported that as part of his plans to make efficiency savings, Jeremy Hunt had kind of hinted he was going to roll back the social care charging reforms. So that includes things like the £86,000 cap on an individual's cost of care and the fair cost of care policy, which would allow self-funders to access their care at the same rates that local authorities pay. Now, councils, especially kind of the County Councils Network, have been saying for a really, really long time that the timeline that this was on wasn't enough time, because these reforms are incredibly complicated and also incredibly expensive. So I think the sector overall welcomed the fact that they had been rolled back. But also you do think about the amount of work that's gone into kind of thinking how they would work already. You know, some areas are the trailblazers of these reforms, kind of piloting them. That's going to have taken time and resource. And, you know, when this the delay was kind of put out in the Times, the CCN and the LGA basically said, you know, it's great, we need that more time, but can't come without sort of proper funding of social care, because social care is really a massive issue, or the cost of it is really a massive issue for councils at the moment.
They were kind of saying, give us the funding anyway. And I think that was the whole issue with these reforms, was they didn't really solve the most pressing issue with social care at the moment, which is just its availability and the workforce, or certainly that's the most pressing issue from council's perspective. So, you know, they could easily spend that money, but given where we are and departments have been told to look for spending cuts, you have to question whether it's likely they're going to get it.
And I think, you know, as part of the mini budget and it was confirmed in the medium term financial plan that Jeremy Hunt put out last week, there was confirmation that the 1.25% increase in national insurance, which was going to be used to fund the health and social care levy, has been cancelled. So, you know, some of that money from the levy had been ring-fenced to pay for these reforms. So if they've cancelled the levy, then they wouldn't have the funding there to pay for these reforms anyway. So they kind of got to be delayed.
Yeah. The past 6 weeks have been mad. It's hard to understate how unprecedented this kind of behaviour from central government is. And, you know, I wrote in my leader for the last magazine issue about, you know, who sends in the commissioners when it's central government that there are concerns about, because we've certainly seen commissioners being sent into a lot of councils of lately over governance concerns, finance concerns, and that's something that Jessica has been looking into and talking to lots of people about. And I caught up with her just before we started recording about what she found.
Hi, Jessica. How are you?
Hello. I'm good.
So we're going to just talk about your big analysis around interventions this week and, the council's different experience of working with commissioners and things. So, I mean, you found that interventions are on the rise. I think there's been four in the past 18 months compared with five in the 12 years before that. And I think even apart from those four, there's places like Croydon and Peterborough that didn't have formal intervention but are subject to oversight and improvement boards. So, I mean, why is intervention on the rise?
Yeah, I mean, according to Tony McArdle, who was the commissioner for Northamptonshire County Council, he doesn't believe that councils are under any more scrutiny now than they were in the days of the Audit Commission.
I'd say they're under less, a lot less, I reckon.
Yeah. But then he's saying the difference is financial. There's a lot less money for councils to play with, and because of that, councils are finding they can't just bumble along the bottom anymore, in his words. And you can see proof of that in the fact that the recent interventions have mainly been finance related. They're councils like Slough, which has had to get capitalisation directions. They've issued Section 114 notices. I think council's financial challenges are only really set to increase, so it's likely that we'll see interventions in the future.
Yeah, there seems to be a theme in recent interventions of councils that have really pushed the boundaries around commercialisation and perhaps some risky investments as well. I mean, do you think that's been a big factor?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we can see in the case of Thurrock, which I had cause to write about this morning because of the tribunal case being Thurrock and basically forcing them to reveal financial details. $1 billion of loans and investments that they've made in recent years.
So just For people that are quite new to this story, so Thurrock, I think, has invested hundreds of millions of pounds, and some of that's in solar farms, and it's borrowed a lot of that money from other local authorities who are now wanting that back. And but all the way through this whole process, it's refused to answer questions, even from its own councillors, and really avoided scrutiny. And then there was a ruling this morning, or that was made public this morning. And what did that say?
That basically said that they have to reveal details of their finances that were requested in a Freedom of Information Act request, except about interest rates. But so it sets an interesting precedent for other councils. But I mean, we can see in the case of Thurrock, I mean, I think the government's been slow to act, really, because Thurrock's been borrowing this money over several years since 2016. And it's only last month that the government made the decision to intervene, and it sent in commissioners from Essex County Council. And you can see this as an example of like a new type of intervention that the government's trialling with Thurrock, of getting a neighbouring authority to intervene. And it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that. And I think there are some questions, though, about the sort of objectivity of a neighbour doing that, because there will be things that they may, you know, that they've both got an interest in, because they're covering a similar patch. And especially when you've got in a two-tier area where there's that history, you know, Thurrock previously having been part of the Essex County Council boundary. So I think a lot of people are watching that with interest. Yeah. It kind of, the sector, local government councils would much prefer the sort of to have a sector-led improvement model, and a lot of that goes on with peer reviews, but there just seems to be a bit of a gap between if a peer review is critical and then the government sending in commissioners. I think there's sort of a gap there, and where there could be more support, or I don't know, but it's a big leap. Do you see what I mean? Is that something that people talk to you about?
It is, and you can see it's something the government are concerned about. I mean, at the end of the day, the government doesn't want to send commissioners areas. It goes against the principle of devolution that it says that it wants to roll out everywhere, and you can see it's also using more and more improvement boards. Those are being set up where they have to report into the government, but they're advisory. Then the council's under no legal obligation to their advice.
But in the meantime, do you think we're going to see more interventions, and are there enough commissioners?
This is the problem. I mean, if you look at the commissioners that we've got at the moment, they're all nearly all around retirement age.
A lot of them, I think, are sort of semi-retired, aren't they?
Yeah. And they tend to have gotten into that position because they've actually previously been chief execs at some point in their career of struggling councils themselves. So they can empathise. They've been there themselves. And the problem is there's not many of them around, and even people that you might think would be good at that job and have those kind of qualifications and experience, it's not something they want to get into. Tony McArdle told me it's long hours. He was recalling his time at Northamptonshire, and it was long hours. Not everybody who has the experience and time wants to do it, he said. So, yeah, where's the next generation of commissioners coming from? It's a big problem. And maybe that's why the government is introduced with Thurrock. It's got Essex doing the intervention rather than appointing their own commissioners, because maybe there is that issue of not having readily available people, independent people who can do it.
Because Gavin Jones, the Essex chief executive, must be the busiest man in local government, because not only is he chief executive of Essex County Council, he's commissioner and chief executive of Slough, and also involved in supporting Thurrock as part of that neighbour improvement support model. So I guess just final question then, do you think interventions work? What do people tell you about that?
This was really surprising, actually, because I was expecting to hear a lot more criticism of the model than I did. But generally, people I'd spoken to who'd been through surprisingly positive about it. So I spoke to Chris Reed, who's the leader of Rotherham Council. And he just talked about how it gave them the opportunity to start from scratch and shape up the way that they did services. So although when we think of Rotherham, we think of acute problems that they had in children's services, the intervention allowed them the opportunity to look at the way that the council was functioning as a whole and make changes there. And Abby Brown, who's the new chair of the LGA's Improvement and Innovation Board, she's also the leader of Stoke-on-Trent Council. And she spoke with a similar tone about intervention in Stoke-on-Trent in their children's services and how it just allowed them to take a bit more of an innovative approach. And then also that, you know, you spend a long time talking about the faults, but then it allows you to see when things are going well, it gives you a chance to see that more clearly. So it's not necessarily all a bad thing. And because there's more intervention on the way, we should definitely look at the positives here.
Yeah, I was really struck by a quote from Theresa Grant, who went into Northamptonshire as chief executive and had commissioners overseeing her. But she's made the point that, you know, she found them as support, but if she'd been the chief exec that had made the decisions that they were now having to unwind and unravel, that would have been an impossible situation. So, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a lot easier if you're a new chief who's not made those mistakes. I think it's a really difficult role being a commissioner, and they're under a lot of pressure. So from members of the public, they're often criticised because their day pay rates that they get, but then they have to stay in hotels. They'll be working for around 3 years. They're normally appointed for the place. And then they are expected to take on the role of members, but they also have to work with elected members to get decisions made. So it's not easy. And they're often criticised. I mean, in Liverpool, we've had them described as Tory commissioners coming in. Of course, they're not Tory commissioners, and they don't see themselves as such at all. But, you know, they're subject to a lot of criticism, which I think some of it's unfair.
Well, thanks, Jessica. It's some fascinating article there that people can read more of on lgcplus.com.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
I think one of our other really big important pieces this week was an interview with the Shadow Housing Minister, Matthew Pennycock. You spoke to him, Megan. What did he have to say?
Yeah, so I met up with Matthew Pennycock last week and we sat down and basically just talked about what he would do if he became Labour's Housing Minister.
And which might happen sooner than we expect.
It could happen in the near future. But yeah, we basically that day or the night before I spoke to Mr. Pennycook was the night that the Times had kind of led with the fact that Simon Clark, the Levelling Up Secretary, was considering getting rid of the ban on Section 21 evictions that the government had put in their renters reform bill, which went out under Michael Gove. And Liz Truss has since confirmed, I mean, not Prime Minister anymore, but when she was, that the government still intends to ban Section 21 evictions, which basically mean that a tenant can be evicted for pretty much no reason if the landlord decides to sell. They're called no-fault evictions. And so Mr. Pennycook and I talked about this and the fact that Labour would definitely want to look at banning Section 21. It wouldn't be kind of he said it's more nuanced than just banning it outright. I think it's got to be accompanied by real reform of the private rented sector, because Mr. Pennycook said there is the risk that if you ban Section 21, landlords will just use exponential rent rises to get rid of tenants. Right. Anyway, so yeah, reforming the private rented sector was a big priority for him. He also said that while he doesn't think banning right to buy is completely the answer, he was very clear that it needs to be reformed. And he gave me a very good quote, which I enjoyed, which was, we need to turn the tap off on right to buy. So I think what he meant by that was kind of reforming the way that we do, the way that councils are able to access receipts from right to buy. So at the moment, councils don't quite get the full amount of money that comes from a social property being sold off. Yeah, some of it goes to the treasury.
The treasury, and nobody's quite sure what happens to it.
Yeah, and the LGA has been saying for a really long time that councils should be getting 100% of right to buy receipts, because then they can channel that back into building more houses. Now, Stuart Andrew, who was like three housing ministers ago, back in February, said that the government made a mistake when it didn't replace the houses that it sold off under right to buy. And I think that for councils is a massive issue. The fact that this policy, which has been going on for kind of years, you know, it's introduced under Margaret Thatcher, we haven't done one-for-one replacement, and we really should have. And it means that council's social housing stock is like kind of completely, well, not completely depleted, but there is a massive shortage of it. So I spoke to Mr. Pennycook about that, and
I think that, I mean, the right to buy, you know, some of the discounts in London, I think, are like up to £100,000, and it's just kind of crazy, really. And if you're sat there and you haven't been fortunate enough to get into social housing, and you're in the private rented sector, you struggle to save any kind of deposit, let alone £100,000. So I think there's kind of a real fairness issue there as well, and also, you know, lots of kind of councils now are actually looking to buy back properties that have been sold under right to buy, I think, especially where they're in sort of blocks of flats and things, because it makes the management of it more difficult as well. So I think, I think probably cross-party in local government, there wouldn't be too much resistance to some reforms.
I was at a session of the APPG for London on Monday, and Georgia Gould, the chair of London councils, was there, and she was saying kind of what you've just said about councils looking to buy back social homes, that there really needs to be a proper strategy on acquisition, and how councils do kind of collect more stock for their housing stock, so that they have homes to kind of to keep residents who fall into homelessness for reasons like Section 21, to stop them from kind of living in temporary accommodation for longer than they need.
You wrote a really interesting LGC briefing this week about all the different, ending Section 21 on its own is not enough to sort of solve the problems in the rental market. I mean, what else needs to happen?
Yeah, I think reforming housing benefit and making sure that properties actually, or the cost of rent matches the amount that people are able to access in housing benefit, is a massive issue. Because, for example, at that same meeting that I attended with Georgia Gould, London councils have done some research, and on certain days, searches of property websites revealed that there were no three-bedroom properties across the whole country available at the housing benefit cap. None. Like, not a single one. And that's, you know, that shows that, yeah, London councils did that research. It's not a London problem, though. Yeah. This is something that seriously needs to be tackled, because the thing is people just... housing benefit is not supporting people in the way that it was set up to, and that's providing a massive problem.
Yeah. We should say it's called local housing allowance now.
Yeah,
it?
Yeah. So there's that, and then there's also the right to buy question, but then there also needs to be more support for councils to kind of build more affordable housing. And when I was talking to Matthew Pennycook, he said that a lot of that kind of relates to ensuring that councils are equipped to be able to properly get the support and the funding from developers to do that, through things like Section 106 and the new infrastructure levy that the government wants to introduce. I mean, Mr. Pennycook said Labour wouldn't be carrying that forward, but what they would look to do is properly resource planning departments, so that there is the expertise in there and the kind of manpower to be able to properly get the funds and the support needed in order to kind of push on with affordable house building. So yeah,
it's a huge issue and one that's not going away, but I think we are running out of time. I think we've gone way over time, but so much to talk about this week. So thank you very much for listening. Remember, you can always find out more about all the stories we've been discussing and lots more at lgcplus.com. If you enjoyed listening, please like and subscribe. And if you want to subscribe, you can use the code ROUNDUP, all capital letters, to get 10% off. And if you did enjoy listening, you can also check out our monthly podcast, The Local Authority, which takes a more in-depth look at some of the challenges facing councils. And I think we've got an episode coming out next week on the cost of living, so look out for that. And the news roundup will be back next week when, who knows, we might have a new Prime Minister already.
Oh dear.
We'll see you then. Thanks for listening.